Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's a great pleasure to have with us as our first guest a man who brings, well, not only intelligence, but a great deal of common sense, practical business experience to bear on his duties as a member of the United States House of Representatives. He is Representative Ralph Norman. He represents with distinction the people of the 5th District of South Carolina, and he is a member, among other things, of the House Science Committee and has, in that capacity, spent some time thinking about, well, particularly a subject of great concern to this program, namely the vulnerability of our electric grid. And I had a chance to hear the congressman addressing this topic at a very important meeting last week in Capitol Hill, the DuPont Summit, it's called, brought to us by InfraGuard, a partnership between the FBI and the private sector, aimed at trying to do, among other things, a securing of America's most critical of critical infrastructures. And Congressman Norman, it was great to meet you on the margins of that meeting and to have a chance to get a sense of your conviction, which I fully share, that this is an absolutely imperative national security mission for our government to address at every level, not just at the federal. But I'm anxious to hear your thoughts as to the seriousness of the problem of grid, well, lack of resiliency, I guess you'd say, and what you think we might do about it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a severe crisis, national crisis that we've got to address. And you know, the old saying that we don't know what we don't know. The American people need to be aware of a threat that any terrorist could have on this country, which is disrupting our grid. And we've gone to the summit last week. I tried to emphasize the fact that we've got the professionals that know what to do. And we just have to make sure that the power companies, those that are in control of our grid, understand it, take the precautions to make sure it doesn't happen. And I guess the big question, what's the downside? Once we know we've got a problem, why not do that? And so it's like having a house and having no locks. And when we go to the power companies, particularly the pilot project in our area, they really didn't answer what's being done to protect it. And that's the reason I raised the awareness of it and hope it'll continue.
Well, I do as well. And of course, as you know, as a member of the Science Committee in the Congress, which has space and technology issues as part of its portfolio, even if an enemy, as you say, which has the capability and understands our vulnerability, chooses not to attack the grid with potentially catastrophic effects for our country, Mother Nature is going to do it at some point. These, you know, intensive solar storms, as they're called, Carrington events, are in our future, and we either prepare for it and survive it, or we, I'm afraid, may not. Your thoughts again on the urgency of this and the fact that to this point we've seen a lack of, well, a sense of that urgency, I'm sorry to say, to some extent, even on the part of the Trump administration.
Well, I think it's, you know, when you hear problems that we have from immigration to, you know, all the issues that that are impacting this country, you kind of go down the list, and this just, the awareness has just not been there. And that was my issue. And if you take it down to the basic level, think about it. What can we do if we don't have power? In other words, when a hurricane comes through, we're without power. What can you do? The banks can't operate. People can't sell their stocks. People can't keep their food frozen. And it's the basic problem that we got to address. And it's not about money. Once we make the problem people aware of it, the companies ought to take heed and say, we're going to just fix this or protect it. And again, what's the downside?
Yeah. Well, one thing I was heartened by, as I know one of your constituents, Ambassador Henry Cooper, an old friend of mine and great partner in much of this, was telling the summiteers about the efforts that Duke Power is now making in collaboration with him and others, both in North and South Carolina, to try to get some enhancements made to the grid down there. And I think this is a showcase for what needs to be done nationwide. And I appreciate your efforts on raising awareness. You mentioned one of the other challenges that, of course, we're facing at the moment, and this is top of mind because of the throwdown that the president had with Chuck and Nancy, as he calls them, yesterday. We'll talk a little bit more about this with Diana West shortly, but I did want to get your thoughts, Congressman Ralph Norman, about the necessity of securing our southern border, building what the president has euphemistically called the wall for that purpose, and what the path ahead looks like now, as you see it, with the government shutdown perhaps looming and the president saying this is something he's going to insist upon.
Well, I was glad the president did what he did. The nation got to see a president who was elected on securing our borders, and he pretty well drew the line in the sand that he's going to shut the government down unless he gets his $5 billion. And think about this. Why could the Obama erode a country like Iran, and we can't find $5 billion to secure our borders? And it's ludicrous. So I'm glad it happened. I, along with a lot of others, will sit up here until hell freezes over if we can just get this wall funded. The irony is, after the gavel passes, with Pelosi as speaker, if she becomes speaker on January 3rd, our prospects of getting any kind of border security goes down the drain. They don't want it. They believe in sanctuary cities. They want illegals to vote to keep their power intact. So that's why we have got to, within 2 weeks, get it done. And I just left a meeting where one of the specialists that were explaining the problem is, in 2 weeks, it's up to us to do something. And I hope we have a vote. As Nancy Pelosi said, we don't have the votes. Well, let's see if we have the votes in the House. Let the House vote. I think we can get 218. And then let's let the Senate take it up. And let's see if the 10 senators will end cloture and find a spine to fund something that's in the national best interest of every American.
Yeah. And that's really the point, isn't it, Congressman Norman? This isn't a partisan issue. It shouldn't be. This is something, and we've seen bipartisan calls for border security and building secure fences and so on over the years, but we're all on the line here. And as friends of mine have been pointing out on this program and elsewhere, you know, every state is a border state now because this problem is interior to our country, not just at the borders. But if we don't prevent further intrusions by caravans or individuals, terrorists or, you know, drug traffickers or what have you, this is a national security problem of the first order that will affect all of us. And we appreciate your leadership on this, Congressman Ralph Norman. Thank you for taking some time to talk to us about both of these important issues. I appreciate your service to our country and look forward to having you back in the new year and new Congress and hopefully getting the job done on the wall in the meantime.
Well, my pleasure, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, sir. We'll talk to Diana West about all this and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is our pleasure to be joined each week by Diana West, a remarkable national asset, as I see her, in terms of understanding and helping the rest of us make sense of the culture war, among other things, the fight for freedom in our country that is being waged, well, on so many fronts, but notably in academia and in the history books and in the world of politics. And she is, of course, a longtime syndicated columnist. She does a marvelous blog, dianawest.net. You can find her writings at places like The Daily Caller these days. She is also the author of two terrific books, The Death of the Grown-Up and American betrayal. Diana, welcome back. So good to have you.
Yes, thank you.
Well, I was just listening to National Public Radio this morning talking about a seeming revelation to them. I think it's a Clemson University study that has been released about Russian influence operations, that it turns out they're not just interested in influencing our election, but everybody's elections, basically, and otherwise using propaganda and disinformation as black arts to affect policies or at least electoral outcomes in countries like this. This is surely not a surprise to you, nor is it exclusively the case that the Russians are engaged in this sort of thing. Indeed, there's a report that the Trump administration has decided to throw $40 million into the mix at something called the Global Engagement Center at the State Department to try to counter some of this disinformation but from the Russians, from the Chinese, from the Iranians. Tell us, as a serious student of these matters, what you make of all of this and what it portends for our ability to do a better job of countering such influence operations in our country from overseas and Russia and elsewhere in the future.
Yes, well, I have not studied Clemson's approach to this matter, but as a general rule of thumb, I would hope that this is conducted in a way that is not superficial. In other words, countries throw propaganda at each other all the time. Certainly, the United States is engaged. It has long had information agencies, state information agencies, which may be also framed as propaganda for the rest of the world. So this is something that countries do to try to shape the world that they make their way in. What the problem becomes is when this disinformation is essentially becomes carried by Americans or agents or useful fools and other assets of a hostile foreign government. And this is something that I study and become quite concerned about over many generations, with the lack of discernment that assets and agents of a foreign state actually infiltrate our institutions, our both political parties, our government, certainly our media. And this is something that is not easily looked at just by seeing Russian bots or, you know, state propaganda news outlets like Russia Today or things like that. So if you study the surface, you're never going to get to what's really subverting your institutions.
Yeah. And this useful idiot business is not to be underestimated. It's something that we have seen, of course, going back to Lenin's day. You've documented it brilliantly in American Betrayal, Diana. Both the useful idiots as well as the actual agents of influence, or for that matter, spies inside of our government. And this is not simply something for the history books, is it? This is something that we see in our own time as well, and whether it's called deep state or whether it's, you know, even more subversive than that, the resistance and so on, the impact that foreign governments can have by using such instruments internal to our polity can't be underestimated.
No, and we've essentially been stripped of our entire counterintelligence capabilities or even understanding that such things exist. I mean, you and I have talked about the Constitution, the oath we uphold our Constitution by against enemies, foreign and domestic. We do have domestic enemies. And, you know, again, looking at normal state propaganda is really not, you know, state actor propaganda is not where you find real threats to your institutions that have completely subverted teaching and religion and government. I mean, this is a real corrosive internal problem that people don't look at because we have been stripped of our counterintelligence sensitivities.
Yeah, and in some cases, I'm afraid, our capabilities to provide counterintelligence. It's a yawning problem in our national security firmament. Dana, all of this has some other implications as well, as useful idiots or agents of influence at home and abroad have been working on changing the character of our country by population transfers. And I was interested in your thoughts about this migration pact that was signed earlier this week in Marrakesh, Morocco, by a vast number of countries, not the United States, not several members of the European Union, but the vast majority. Tell us what's in this pact and what it might portend if, as some warn, this non-binding agreement, as it's called, is cited to by federal judges in this country and thereby becomes somehow binding norms or international legal requirements internal to the United States as well.
Yes, the United States is not a signatory to this pact, as are a number of countries that have woken up to the dangerous effect of this, yes, non-binding. That's the word that its supporters keep throwing around. It's non-binding, and yet it's filled with all kinds of commands and directives directed at the states that sign on to it, and frankly, anyone else in the vicinity of the state or the United Nations. I mean, this is a really dangerous, poisonous kind of influence operation, I would don't think it's exaggerating to call it, that is put forward by the United Nations to create a world that has no borders, no state control, that goes right to the United Nations for the conduct and regulation and enablement of mass migration from the third world into Europe, the United States primarily. Australia as well. Australia's not a signatory. United States not a signatory. Number of Eastern and a couple of Western European countries are not signatories, from Austria, Czech Republic, Italy, Hungary, etc. However, 160 plus countries have signed on. What that means for the rest of us remains to be seen, but the pressure will be enormous. One of the most dangerous sorts of directives in this pact is an objective that relates to discussion of migration. And they call it an objective, Objective 17, eliminate all forms of discrimination and promote evidence-based public discourse to shape perceptions of migration. I mean, this is a call for all kinds of censorship or censorious expression according to UN dictates. I mean, this is very serious stuff. So what are we looking at? We're looking at United Nations, whose leaders are openly hostile to nations. The UN Secretary General today, Guterres, is a Portuguese socialist. I mean, once upon a time, and, you know, there are a number of socialists in senior positions at the United Nations. It is a globalist. I mean, it defines globalism as an organization. It was set up by Soviet agent Alger Hiss back in 1945, the Secretary General. And in another day, our more counterintelligence savvy ancestors would have looked at it as a communist front, as a front organization breaking down national sovereignty. And so this pact is simply their latest gambit that seems to be, you know, moving ahead as a non-binding, cooperative kind of lovely piece of legislation or non-legislation that will shape our future, and we will be feeling this. So buckle up and leave the United Nations. It's really the only hope for any of this. Take the money we put into the billions we put into United Nations peacekeeping, all the different budgets that add up to, I don't know, $10 billion or something like that, and build our wall. I mean, that would be a perfect way to better use American taxpayer money than actually sending hundreds of fat cats to Marrakesh to have parties under beautiful tents and work on our destruction. I mean, I think that would be a good solution.
Well, speaking of the wall and the importance of border security to our sovereignty, there was, of course, a throwdown by the president yesterday with the Senate and House Democratic leaders, respectively, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, over this issue of the wall, to the point where the president says, listen, I'm going to shut down the government, or at least the part of the government that hasn't yet been funded by a permanent appropriations measure for this year, or at least the non-essential personnel of that, you know, part of the government. But talk us through this, Dinah West. This is, of course, something that was a critical part, I think, of Donald Trump's candidacy in 2016. He's been frustrated at every turn by both Republicans and Democrats, to be fair, in the Congress over the past 2 years. Should he, in fact, be taking this important step of saying no wall, those non-essential personnel from these several agencies will not be turning up for work, at least temporarily.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was a truly superb display of high Trumpism in the Oval Office with these two Senate and House Democratic leaders, Chuck and Nancy. It showed who was the leader and who was the political prankster. I mean, this was just a fabulous illustration to the American people of what President Trump really is all about when it comes to defending the country against these politicians who wanted, if you notice, to take everything off camera into private and had to be told by President Trump. It's called transparency when you have this kind of discussion in front of the press. It's called transparency.
Dinah, I appreciate so much what you do at dinahwest.net and with us each week. We look forward to our conversation next week. And in the meantime, be well and keep up the great work, my friend.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's my great pleasure to say, joined by a man that I've come to admire tremendously for his intellect, for his clarity, for his courage in describing the public policy choices facing our country in so many different arenas, but most immediately and most especially, perhaps, with respect to what has come to be called the First Step Act. This is a bill that is now awaiting action. We're told Mitch McConnell will bring up this legislation perhaps as early as late this week as part of a larger criminal justice reform agenda. Daniel Horowitz has been very critical of this agenda and this act in particular. He is a senior editor at Conservative Review, now part of the Blaze Media operation, I believe, and one of the most prolific and thoughtful contributors, as I say, to the public policy issues and debates about them of our time. His newest book is Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. We're always glad to have him with us, but most especially today. Daniel, I know this is a very busy moment for you. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about the First Step Act.
Really appreciate the opportunity, and yes, it truly is a troubling day.
It is indeed. So one of the reasons that it's troubling, it seems to me, is the process that is being applied here to a very consequential piece of legislation. Just remind us what's going on with this legislation and how, as I think of it, the adage, you want it bad, you get it bad, seems to be applying.
I've never quite seen an issue like this in my entire career, a public policy issue like this, at a time when we have a crisis with transnational cartels, transnational gangs, mainly foreign nationals responsible for the worst drug crisis in this country that everyone recognizes. I just spoke with officials in DEA and ICE in New England, and they say that these drug traffickers, which are largely fueled by illegal immigration, these illegal gangs and cartels are single-handedly responsible for the thousands of fatalities in New Hampshire, Maine, and Massachusetts. These very people are the ones that now these geniuses in Washington want to A, early release from prison, and B, at the front end, reduce sentencing for the drug traffickers. And again, these are the people that the federal prosecutors go after. They're the gangbangers. These are the top-level people. They don't go after the small little pushers and give them 30 years. It's a myth. It certainly not hasn't been done in 15 years. And priorities. I mean, we have an immigration crisis. We have a budget crisis. But this is the one issue for which they're willing to stay through Christmas for.
Yeah. You know, as it happens, this morning I heard on National Public Radio piece that was relatively sympathetic treatment of police officers, interestingly enough, primarily because it was documenting how fewer and fewer people are willing to become police officers, and the workload that is currently weighing on those who are serving is that much more intense, of course. And it sort of ended with this, slightly wistful line that we sure hope that we'll be able to continue to keep crime rates relatively low despite the reduced number of law enforcement officers tasked with that job. This would seem to be a bad time to be letting out large numbers of people, even if one claims, as we endlessly hear, Daniel Horowitz, that they're nonviolent criminals, to add to the burden of those law enforcement personnel, especially given the high recidivism rates that seem to be associated with a lot of these crimes. Talk us through that, if you would.
Well, no, they're going to cure recidivism because they have to engage in, quote, productive activities and programs that show some proof that they're reduce recidivism. I mean, this bill is Orwellian. To speak to your point, here's the issue. They want to have it both ways. They want the talking point of saving money, but then they want to release, I mean, literally 4,000 immediately and then tens of thousands more over time. And again, the people in the federal system, you have to understand the federal system is distinct from the state system. It's a backstop to the state system. So federal prosecutors will only go after these guys that are most often the big gangbangers that are responsible for murder, robbery, arson, all sorts of things. And the easiest tool they have to lock them up are the drug charges, but often they're even worse than that. And that's bad enough, given the drug crisis. So you release these people out over a short period of time, but they don't want to fund more resources because then, you know, they can't have the talking point that they're saving money. And this is what the prison wardens pointed out. The prison wardens union opposes this. Another example of this is that they allow, even aside from the jailbreak component within prison, they mandate hundreds of minutes more of phone time and internet time and rec time. This stuff is very dangerous. When you're talking about the El Chapo type of people in prison, you really need more wardens to monitor that, but they don't appropriate the resources, and they do so purposely. The National Sheriff's Association has pointed out the unfunded liability this will be on local law enforcement, how they're going to deal with the home confinement of thousands more. I mean, this thing hasn't been thought out. I could go on and on about the provisions, but this bill, as Chuck Grassley said before he flipped on the issue, it's promoted as a matter of ideology, and it's Orwellian, where facts simply don't matter.
Well, the thing that's peculiar about it is that the right seems to be enthralled with this ideology of the left as well. Van Jones is one of the principal drivers behind this, and as a communist hardline guy on the left, he would seem an unlikely ally for some of the people that we work with all the time on the right, Daniel Horowitz. Explain what the ideology is that's operating here.
Well, CNN, MSNBC, The New York Times, they exist to tell us, I guess, that we are fecal matter. Fox News exists to tell us that the fecal matter on us is really water, and it's good. This is the problem. This is our leadership. We have Fox News that for the first time in 30 years took a position on a bill, which should tell your listeners everything they need to know about the nature, the insidious nature of how this is being pushed. The masters of the universe, all the globalists, all the people that decide what's moral and right have decided this is their issue du jour. I mean, and think about it. Whatever you believe on the issue, where the heck did this come from? I mean, we have emergencies on sanctuary cities at the border. We have literally 3,000 people a day being apprehended at the border. That's a pace of a million a year. And there's no impetus to act on it. Yet when it comes to this, there's some hellfire emergency because, again, the so-called conservative leadership and all their outlets are rotten to the core. I could go on and on about Fox News, but this is the problem.
Yeah. So there is a head of steam up behind this, that's for sure. The provenance of it seems to have something to do with people like George Soros and the Koch brothers, among others. I wonder whether, Daniel, you would find it fair to say that this has not gotten the kind of scrutiny, particularly the bill that is seemingly being changed by the moment, that it would warrant, given the kind of far-reaching implications that it should have. And if so, that we're likely to see in this lame duck, as we have frequently in the past, major sweeping legislation with profound implications for public safety, public health, public, you know, the national security perhaps as well, being blown through without the kind of care that is simply necessary.
this is such a complex issue that it's inextricably tied into transnational drug trafficking, illegal immigration. And then, yes, you mentioned national security. As Chuck Grassley, again, before the Kochs bought him off, gave a whole speech in 2014 that back then, and certainly more so 4 years later, increasingly terrorism, particularly Hezbollah, is turning to drug trafficking, cocaine in particular, as the honeypot to fund their terrorism. So when you get rid of mandatory minimums and you have all these leniencies, you reduce a lot of the leverage you have as an investigative tool to bust up these networks. I mean, there's so many consequences we haven't held hearings on. They put this behind closed doors. They don't want to have a protracted debate over it. This is driven by insanity. It's all the masters of the universe, the corporate cultural institutions are all behind it. And wait a minute. I mean, people forget that along with the destruction of the Soviet Union, the 70% decline in violent crime in this country is the biggest legacy of Ronald Reagan. It was because of these drug trafficking laws and the gun trafficking laws and the Armed Career Criminal Act that they want to gut now, that we took all these people off the streets. Because the truth be told, we need criminal justice reform, all right? We need to make it easier to land a conviction on these violent people. Too many of them get off. Hundreds of thousands every year, murder, robbery, rape, aggravated assault, cases go uncleared because it's so hard to land a conviction. What the drug laws did is it gave us the ability to take them off the streets, and that is why we actualized this decline in crime in the 90s and early 2000s, and we're slowly reversing that in major urban areas because the pendulum has already swung back the other way, even without any leniencies. Maybe there was a time, you know, 2000 to 2005 era at a state level, maybe we were locking up too many people for simple possession. That none of that is happening now, and none of that at a federal level.
Yeah, and that's really such a key point, Daniel Horowitz. There does seem to be room for improvement on recidivism training, perhaps, and sentencing and the like at the state level in a number of states around the country. But what you've pointed out so eloquently is at the federal level, you're talking about serious, hardened criminals who are in the federal system. And to the extent that we're going to actually turn these guys loose on the basis that reforms are warranted elsewhere at the other levels of the criminal justice system is just kind of a mind-boggling error and of great import, obviously. Daniel Horowitz, thank you for your critical analysis at Conservative Review, Daniel, and for all that you do to try to make sure that these kinds of issues are getting the scrutiny that they require. God bless you. Keep up the good work and come back to us again, if you would, very soon.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we are joined, as we are from time to time, by Colonel Dr. Lawrence Sellin, United States Army Reserves, retired, a man with an extraordinary degree of expertise and accomplishments in uniform, including two tours in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. As a combat infantryman, he has, however, branch qualifications in the special forces as well as the chemical and medical services, a man of many parts who writes these days extraordinarily powerfully at the Daily Caller. We're always happy to catch up with him. Dr. Colonel Sellin, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
Among other things you've been writing about, born of a lot of hard experience you've had in Afghanistan, Lawrence, is what is going on there at the moment? And specifically, what is America's policy towards that long-suffering nation? Specifically, you've taken to task General Stanley McChrystal, who formerly commanded U.S. forces there, for, well, saying basically the obvious about what we're doing, namely that our policy is one of muddling through. Talk about McChrystal and how we got to this pass.
Yes, that's right, Frank. I think McChrystal's statement was a stunning admission. Let me explain what's happening here. The Pentagon usually first states what is called the end state, what it wants to achieve. And this in Afghanistan, this is that country should not become a terrorist base from which attacks can be launched against the United States. Now, everyone agrees with this, so this is not a problem. The problem is what we call the ways and means. That is, you know, what do we do to reach that end state? Now, presently, the United States is fighting with the Afghans against the Taliban, but simultaneously, it's also training the Afghans with the idea that eventually the Afghans will take over the entire mission against the Taliban. Now, this is not working. The Afghan casualty rate is presently exceeding the replacement rate. So the program itself is unsustainable. Now, instead of trying something new, the Pentagon has decided, as you say, to just muddle along, hoping something good might happen. So this is really both tragic and stupid.
Yeah. You've also been pretty critical of the Trump administration for cluelessness with respect to this war. Talk a little bit about that. And, you know, Donald Trump came into office, I think, pretty firm that he envisioned getting out of Afghanistan. How is it that he has become part of this muddling through, given his attitude going in?
Well, I think President Trump's instincts to begin with were correct, that there really wasn't a policy adequate to reach the end state that the Pentagon decided upon. But I think he was convinced by a lot of the advisors around him.
Notably H.R. McMaster.
Well, absolutely, to begin with. But now it seems that the policy is going to continue. I wouldn't put the blame on him in this case exclusively.
So to the extent that we've got muddling through as essentially the policy of the United States government, you've very clearly warned Lawrence Ellen about a very different policy approach, much more clear, much more promising, I guess you might say, from their point of view at least. That is now emerging from China with respect to Afghanistan with the help of their Pakistani allies. Talk us through that, if you would.
So what I'd like to say about what President Trump has done, he's actually taken positive steps in terms of dealing with Pakistan, which is really the problem. It's not the Taliban per se, but it's the support of Pakistan for the Taliban. Now, what he's done so far is essentially withheld rewards from Pakistan. So we really haven't punished Pakistan in a way that they would feel the pain enough to reduce or eliminate their support for the Taliban. And I think one of the major pain points that Pakistan has is ethnic separatism. And this is something that can affect not only Pakistan, but as you suggested, China's investment in Pakistan. So I think this is a more fruitful policy that the United States can pursue.
Specifically, exploiting essentially the fault lines in Pakistan to make life very difficult for the government there, as well as for their Chinese patrons, and increasingly the nation that seems determined to colonize Pakistan, or at least parts of it, for their strategic purposes through this so-called China-Pakistan Economic Compact. When you look at what that compact has in mind for Afghanistan, though, Lawrence Ellen, how does it shape up in terms of what it portends, especially in the absence of an American policy for Afghanistan of our own?
Well, that's right, Frank. Contrary to the United States, which doesn't seem to have a viable policy in Afghanistan, both China and Pakistan do. And really, they have steps planned out in terms of removing United States influence from South Asia and then attaining dominance in the region. And the first step actually is to increase the number of attacks by the Taliban in Afghanistan. And I've heard from sources on the ground that Pakistan is actually moving members of the terrorist group Lashkar-e-Taiba, which usually operates in Kashmir against India, into Afghanistan. And also I've heard that the Pakistani government has been trying to recruit former Pakistani military people to help in the effort in Afghanistan. So they're taking steps to accelerate operations by the Taliban in Afghanistan with the hope that it will push the United States into a negotiation that is really detrimental to our overall interests.
Wow, no kidding. This would be pretty much an overt act of warfare against the United States by the Pakistanis, and they should be held accountable for this. What is the end state, as you see it, Lawrence Ellen, that China aspires to have come out of Afghanistan? There are immense natural resources there that they've clearly already begun to exploit under our protection, ironically. Is it to essentially be able to do that on a vastly greater scale under a Taliban restored government with the Pakistanis as their principal enabler?
Well, I think what China's hoping for is a ceasefire in Afghanistan and then employing pro-Chinese, pro-Pakistani Afghan politicians together with a Taliban component to establish a coalition government. And through that, they are probably looking towards inviting Afghanistan into the China-Pakistan economic corridor to incorporate Afghanistan in their attempts for economic dominance in South Asia.
Yeah, and this corridor is, of course, at the core of what we are watching the Chinese do in Pakistan as well, which is to say to establish, as you've documented, port facilities and power projection capabilities that are going to be kind of the flagship of the whole Belt and Road Initiative. And Lawrence, just in conclusion, as you see it right now, if the president were to say, I want a different policy, I want to create real pain for the Pakistanis doing what they're doing and further complicate China's efforts to fill the vacuum of power in this part of the world, does it come down basically to this idea of helping promote separatist elements within Pakistan?
That's right, Frank. There already is a resistance movement inside Pakistan among the Baluchis, the Pashtuns, and the Sindhis. I think this is an opportunity for the United States to exploit that resistance and put pressure, real pressure, on Pakistan to come to terms with its support of the Taliban. And also, there's a possibility that we can inhibit Chinese ambitions in South Asia because they seek dominance in the region. And through this work with these ethnic groups, we might be able to slow down or even halt that.
This sounds like really important work and would not require boots on the ground, as I understand it. This is essentially the financial support and maybe some political assistance in Washington and elsewhere, but a really important alternative to muddling through. And Lawrence Ellen, I appreciate so much you taking some time to walk us through it. We hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.